Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we will be discussing The Brothers Karamazov, Book 8, Chapter 2, then reading half of Chapter 3. Just half, because I left it a bit late tonight. It's 2:20 a.m. Why did I do that? I don't know. I was binge-watching The Good Place. One thing came to another. And now it's 2:20 in the morning. Good Place, good show. Very easy to watch. Very easy to half-watch. I think I tuned out for whole chunks of 5 or 10 minutes at a time, but... Anyway, what are we talking about? Oh yeah, The Brothers Karamazov. The questions I asked is this: Mitya is going to see Grushenka. Discuss. And who is Golitskin? Terrific said, I've said it before and I'll say it again. Mitya is such an odd character. Is he believable or not? I'm on the fence. But he's so extreme, and just when I thought I had him pegged down for being a construct, Dosto pulls some psychology out of his hat and Mitya is believable again. Case in point in the last chapter was his deep sense that he could not live off Grushenka's money. It disgusted him. And we know why, of course, because that was what his father did to his mother. I don't know, guys, how do you feel about Mitya so far? In this chapter, he goes on this wild goose chase and ends up right where he started, but now with a quite foolproof plan. Shaking my head. It all sounds very interesting. I wish I had have read that chapter where any of those things happened. All I read was a bunch of unintelligible, long-winded, confusing sentences which amounted to absolutely nothing. The only thing I can tell you about the previous chapter is that Mitya was in it, which I can't even really remember, except for the fact that we're discussing Mitya. This book, for me, it is so uncanny the way I can read a whole chapter and just nothing is retained. Nothing is even... It's not that it's not even retained. It's not... I just don't comprehend it as I read it. Each sentence is just... It's all twisted and muddled up. So they've just put this barrier to entry for every single chapter. Like, we don't actually want you to understand every single sentence in this book. I don't know. It's the most crazy way to write a book. And I understand that the other... translations are a lot better, and I really wish I was reading one of the like the intelligible translations and not this unintelligible one, because whenever you guys discuss what happened in the chapter, I'm like, that sounds interesting. I wish I had read that. But it's the weirdest thing, everything you guys discuss, everything you say that happened in it, and you're like, oh, and obviously this, and clearly that now, and it's just it's crazy to me, because I have no recollection of anything that you're mentioning in this discussion. Like, literally, if I finished the chapter and then asked you, what was that chapter about, what happened, and you just gave me a summary of a random different chapter from anywhere in the book, further along in the book, I would be like, cool, okay, righto, that's what happened. Like, I would not be able to tell you whether or not you're lying. Because every chapter so far, I read it, and then you guys tell me what happened, and I'm like, are we reading the same book? What the hell? Anyway, I am Norwegian said, I have no idea what to think of Dmitri anymore. From the very beginning of his introduction, I did not like him, especially contrasted with Alyosha and Ivan. Dmitri came off as entitled and little more, but when we were really introduced to him, and he got a chance to speak for himself, he seemed genuine, both in his words and his struggle. But I've learned more about him and the way he thinks. I'm just puzzled, like I was for a long time hearing Katerina Ivanovna rant. Here, I grew to understand, but not Mitya. Dmitri is exasperating, said Swim, said the Momofishi, and clueless and generous. He paid the forester 50 kopecks for the trouble he had caused, and egalitarian. It appears he treats the peasants, who also gave him money, as equals. Ivan thinks too much, and Dmitri doesn't think at all. I don't remember which one is which. I remember, is Ivan the murderous one, or Dmitri the angry one? And I'm pretty sure Dmitri is the one in the love triangle with Grushenka. Ivan must then be the smart one. just guessing. None of them have personalities to me. They're just names with like attributes. But I cannot for the life of me even begin to picture what it would be like to talk to them, or what, how they would make you feel as a character if you were in their presence. Nothing. Just the blandest, most blank nothingness. Anyway, Jordanzi said, I think this is an important part of Dimitri's character you point out here, although I'm not sure I'd call it generosity. There are a few examples of where he goes out of his way to ensure people are compensated properly, thinking to leave the 50 kopeck payment despite his state of mind, and this whole crazy scheme to pay back Katerina. He obviously feels he's owed something from Fyodor. I wonder if that will play into his inevitable conflict coming up. I Am Norwegian says, Gort's skin is lurcher. My intuition was right, and he did stroke his beard. You didn't need to be Sherlock Holmes to read that situation, though, and it ended up being very relevant. Still, a fun detail. Again, I missed it. I know Gortskin and Lurcher, and they talked about the towel, and I think he sold him something, like wood or something like that. I don't really know. Uncle Drosselmeyer said, Mitchell lives on a world of his own and cannot tell fiction from reality. He is tortured by jealousy and carried away by passions and fears. It is worrisome just to see him put all his hopes in the will of strangers, people who laugh at him. He is a kid lost in the woods. Again, zero of that I had interpreted. If you had just described Mitcher, Uncle Drosselmeyer, in all the exact opposite terms that you used, I would accept it just as much as what you've said. Henry Loz said, I fear that we might be seeing the last days of Mitcher. Probably a spoiler, maybe, but all I can say is let's hope so. Let's hope that the characters all die off one by one. And I'll shrug myself to sleep. Meh. Like that. Because I have zero investment in any of them. This is the worst book I've ever read. Easily. And the great thing about it is it gives me a lot of confidence in my own writing because... I don't know. I just know unequivocally that I can write better than what we're seeing in this book. Sounds boastful, but for me it's just... Yeah, that's just... I can just say that without any doubt. This is the worst book I've ever read. And I've read Corey Taylor's book. That one where he calls you kids and stuff throughout the whole thing. Listen here, kids. So yeah, I don't know, if there's one thing that this book did do good for me, or is doing, is giving me confidence in my own writing. Because I know I would never disrespect my readers, ever. Anyone who reads my book has my utmost respect as my audience. It's immediately assumed that your time is more valuable, that you are smarter than me as well. I never talk down to my readers. I never spoon-feed my readers either. I never sort of force the story down your throat, spoon-feed it to you. But at the same time, I would never make something more confusing to make me seem smarter. My idea is to make the reading experience as rewarding as possible. And you do not do that by making your writing less accessible. To me, that's an author that does that is someone who's not very confident. Who's kind of got a bit of an inferiority complex. That's all I really read here as I read this. I'd also not intentionally write in a poor prose style. And then claim that it was because I wanted it to seem authentic or whatever it is that he said. So, yeah. I don't know. That's one good thing. Yeah. I feel good about that. Now, I'm not saying I'm better at than Dostoevsky, because I've read other Dosto books, and they are great. They're really good. The ones I've read, Notes from Underground, and a little short story one, which I can't remember what it was called. I can't remember the name of it. but they're really good. They're really, really good. So I think it's either down to the translator, or maybe he was just on a different kind of vibe when he wrote this one. Maybe he was getting too old, or he just got lazy about it. And it seems like he dictated the book into a dictaphone and then just said, yeah, just turn that into words on a page, would you? Anyway, so at least this translation of this book, I know I can write way better than this. So that's cool. Anyway, let's keep reading this piece of shit. This is chapter 3 called Gold Mines. I'm only going to read the first half of it. This was the visit of Mitya, of which Grushenka had spoken to Rakitin with such horror. She had just then expecting the message. She was just then expecting the message, and was much relieved that Mitya had not been to see her that day or the day before. She hoped that, please God, he won't come till I'm gone away, and he suddenly burst in on her. She hoped that, quote, please God, he won't come till I'm gone away, end quote, and he suddenly burst in on her. What does that mean? I can't even get that in a timeline in my head. So she hoped, past tense, and then it just has her thought as a sentence, please God, he won't come till I'm gone away. And then that sentence ends present, and he suddenly burst in on her. This whole book is just that to me. Like, I can't iron that sentence out to figure out, did she hope it and then he burst in on her as she was hoping it? And why was she hoping he won't come till I'm gone away? Where is she going? The whole book is just that for me. Every sentence I'm like, it's just a little puzzle that I don't have the mental capacity to like iron out the kinks of every single sentence that I read. The rest we know already. That's genuinely the next sentence. The rest we know already. Why? Why include that? Why say... Oh my freaking God. The rest we know already. To get him off her hands, she suggested at once that he should walk with her to Samsonov's, where she said she absolutely must go to settle his account. And when Mitya accompanied her at once... What? And when Mitya accompanied her at once, she said goodbye to him at the gate. What? Making him promise to come at 12 o'clock to take her home again. Mitya, too, was delighted at this arrangement. I do not understand this. Okay, so to get him away from her, to get him off her hands, she suggested at once that he should walk with her together. So let's go somewhere together. That'll get you off my hands. Okay? Already I'm confused. To Samsonov's, where she said she absolutely must go to settle his accounts. To settle Mitch's accounts or Samsonov's accounts. And when Mitya accompanied her at once, she said goodbye to him at the gate. Okay, so she did get rid of him by walking with him to the gate, making him promise to come at 12 o'clock to take her home again. So she's trying to get rid of him, but he's being reluctant. Then Mitya too was delighted at that arrangement. Why? Why would that delight you? I don't... None of this book, sentence for sentence, it's just insane. Sentence for sentence, I do not understand this book. If she was sitting at Samsonov's, she could not be going to Fyodor Pavlovich's. If only she's not lying, he added at once. No idea. If she was sitting at Samsonov's... If she was sitting at Samsonov's, she could not be going to Fyodor Pavlovich's. He's happy because... because if she's at Samsonov's, that means she can't be at Fyodor's, and he doesn't want her to go to Fyodor's. If only she's not lying, he added at once. So as long as she's being truthful that she is sitting at Samsonov's, right? Okay. Like, why would you word that in the most confusing possible way? Why would you word that like that? I can think of 1,000 better sentence structures for that sentence where it's just like, you just read it and it unfolds in front of you rather than having to pick it back apart behind you and piece it together. I don't understand why you would choose to make a book more difficult to read. But he thought she was not lying from what he saw. He was the sort of jealous man who, in the absence of the beloved woman, at once invents all sorts of awful fancies of what may be happening to her and how she may be betraying him, but when shaken, heartbroken, convinced of her faithlessness, he runs back to her. At the first glance of her face, her gay, laughing, affectionate face, he revives at once, lays aside all suspicion, and with joyful shame abuses himself for his jealousy. After leaving Grushenka at the gate, he rushed home. Oh, he had so much still to do that day, but a load had been lifted from his heart anyway. Now I must only make haste and find out from Smerkyakov whether anything happened there last night, whether by any chance she went to Fyodor Pavlovich's, oh, floated through his mind. Before he had time to reach his lodging, jealousy had surged up again in his restless heart. Jealousy. Othello was not jealous, he was trustful, observed Pushkin, and that remark alone is enough to show the deep inside of our guest, great poet. Othello's soul was shattered by his whole outlook, clouded simply because his ideal was destroyed, but Othello did not begin hiding, spying, peeping. He was trustful, on the contrary, he had to be led up, pushed on, excited, with great difficulty more, before he could entertain the idea of deceit. The truly jealous man is not like that. It is impossible to picture to oneself the shame and moral degradation to which the jealous man can descend without a qualm of conscience, and yet it's not as though the jealous were all vulgar and base souls. On the contrary, a man of lofty feelings whose love is pure and full of self-sacrifice may yet hide under tables, bribe, vilest people, and familiar with the lowest ignominy of spying and eavesdropping. Othello was incapable of making up his mind to faithfulness. Who the fuck is Othello? Are you talking about Shakespeare now? Othello was incapable of making up his mind to faithlessness, not incapable of forgiving it, but of making up his mind to it. Though his soul was as innocent and free from malice as a babe's, it is not so with the man, the really jealous man. It is hard to imagine what some jealous men can make up their mind and to overlook, and what they can forgive. The jealous are the readiest of all to forgive, and women know it. The jealous man can forgive extraordinarily quickly, though, of course, after a violent scene, and he is able to forgive infidelity, almost conclusively proved, the very kisses and embraces he has seen. If only he can somehow be convinced that it has all been for the last time, and that his rival will vanish from that day forward, will depart to the ends of the earth, or that he himself will carry her away somewhere where that dreaded rival will not get near her. Of course, the reconciliation is only for an hour, for even if the rival did disappear next day, he would invent another one and be jealous of him. And one might wonder what there was in a love that had to be so watched over, what a love could be worth that needed such strenuous guarding. But that the jealous will never understand. And yet among them are men of noble hearts. It is remarkable, too, that those very men of noble hearts, standing hidden in some cupboard, listening and spying, never feel the stings of conscience. What? It is remarkable, too, that those very men of noble hearts, standing hidden in some cupboard, listening and spying, never feel the stings of conscience at that moment. Anyway, though they understand clearly enough with their noble hearts the shameful depths to which they have voluntarily sunk. At the sight of Grushenka, Mitch's jealousy vanished, and for an instant he became trustful and generous, and positively despised himself for his evil feelings. But it only proved that in his love for the woman there was an element of something far higher than he himself imagined, that it was not only a sensual passion, not only the curve of her body, of which he had talked to Alyosha, but as soon as Grushenka had gone, Mitya began to suspect her of all the low cunning of faithlessness, and he felt no sting of conscience at it. And so jealousy surged up in him. He had in any case to make haste. The first thing to be done was to get hold of at least a small temporary loan of money. The 9 rubles had almost all gone on his expedition, and as we all know, one can't take a step without money. But he thought over in his cart where he could get a loan. He had a brace of fine dueling pistols in a case, which he had not pawned till then because he prized them above all his possessions. In the Metropolis Tavern, he had some time since made acquaintance with a young official and had learned that this very opulent bachelor was passionately fond of weapons. He used to buy pistols, revolvers, daggers, hang them on his wall, and show them to acquaintances. He prided himself on them and was quite a specialist on the mechanism of the revolver. Mitya, without stopping to think, went straight to him and offered to pawn his pistols to him for 10 rubles. The official, delighted, began trying to persuade him to sell them outright, but Mitya would not consent. So the young man gave him 10 rubles, protesting that nothing would induce him to take interest. They parted friends. Mitya was in haste. He rushed towards Fyodor Pavlovich's, by the back way, to his arbor, to get hold of Smerdyakov as soon as possible. In this way, the fact was established that 3 or 4 hours before a certain event, of which I shall speak later on, Mitya had not a farthing and pawned for 10 rubles a possession he valued, though 3 hours later he was in possession of thousands, but I am anticipating. From Maya Kondratyevna, the woman living near Fyodor Pavlovich's, he learned the very disturbing fact of Smerdyakov's illness. He heard the story of his fall in the cellar, the doctor's visit, Fyodor Pavlovich's anxiety. He heard with interest, too, that his brother Ivan had set off that morning for Moscow. Then he must have driven through Volovya before me, thought Dmitri, but he was terribly distressed about Smerdyakov. What will happen now? Who'll watch for me? You'll bring me word, he thought. He began greedily questioning the women whether they had seen anything the evening before. They quite understood what he was trying to find out and completely reassured him no one had been there. Ivan Fyodorovich had been there that night. Everything had been perfectly as usual. Mitya grew thoughtful. He would certainly have to keep watch today, but where? Here or at Samsonov's gate? He decided that he must be on the lookout both here and there, and meanwhile. The difficulty was that he had to carry out the new plan that he had made on the journey back. He was sure of its success, but he must not delay acting upon it. Mitya resolved to sacrifice an hour to it. In an hour I shall know everything, I shall settle everything, and then, first of all to Samsonov's. I'll inquire whether Grushenka's there and instantly be back here again to stay till 11, and then to Samsonov's again to bring her home. This is what he decided. He flew home, washed, combed his hair, brushed his clothes, dressed, and went to Madame Holokov's. Alas, had built his hopes on her. He had resolved to borrow 3,000 from that lady, and what was more, he felt suddenly convinced that she would not refuse to lend it to him. It may be wondered why, if he felt so certain. He had not gone to her at first, one of his own sort, so to speak, instead of Samsonov, a man he did not know, who was not of his own class, but to whom he hardly knew how to speak. But the fact was that he had never known Madame Holokov well, and had never seen nothing of her for the last month, and that he knew she could not endure him. She had detested him from the first because he was engaged to Katerina Ivanovna, while she had, for some reason, suddenly conceived the desire that Katerina Ivanovna should throw him over and marry the charming, chivalrous, refined Ivan, who had such excellent manners. Mitya's manners she detested. Mitya positively laughed at her, and had once said about her that she was just as lively and at her ease as she was uncultivated, but that morning in the cart a brilliant idea had struck him. If she is so anxious, I should not marry Katerina Ivanovna, and he knew she was positively hysterical upon the subject. Why should she refuse me now that 3,000 just to enable me to leave Katya and get away from her forever? No expense to satisfy the caprice, besides she's so rich, Mitya argued. As for his plan, it was just the same as before. It consisted of the offer to his rights to Chechmeshnya, but not with a commercial object, as it had been with Samsonov, not trying to allure the lady with the possibility of making a profit of 6,000 or 7,000, but simply as security for the debt. As he worked out his new idea, Mitchell was enchanted with it, but so it always was with him in his undertakings, in all his sudden decisions. He gave himself up to every new idea with passionate enthusiasm, yet when he mounted the steps of Madame Holokov's house, he felt a shiver of fear run down his spine. At that moment he saw fully, as a mathematical certainty, that this was the last hope, that if this broke down, nothing else was left him in the world but to rob and murder someone for the 3,000. It was 7:30 when he rang at the bell. At first fortune seemed to smile upon him. As soon as he was announced, he was received with extraordinary rapidity. "As though she were waiting for me," thought Mitya, as soon as he had been led to the drawing room. The lady of the house herself ran in and declared at once that she was expecting him. "I was expecting you, I was expecting you. Though I had no reason to suppose you would come to see me, as you will admit yourself, yet I did expect you. You may marvel at my instinct, Dmitri Fyodorovitch, but I was convinced all the morning that you would come." "This is certainly wonderful, madame," observed Mitya, sitting down limply. "But I have come to you on a matter of great importance, on a matter of supreme importance for me, that is, madame, for me alone, and I hasten. I know you've come on most important business, Dmitri Fyodorovitch. It's not a case of presentiment, no reactionary harking back to the miraculous. Have you heard about Father Zossima? This is a case of mathematics. You couldn't help coming, after all that has passed with Katerina Ivanovna. You couldn't, that's a mathematical certainty. The realism of actual life, madame, that's what it is, but allow me to explain. Realism indeed, Dmitri Fyodorovitch, I'm all for realism now. I've seen too much of miracles. You've heard that Father Zossima is dead? No, madame, it's the first time I've heard it. Mitya was a little surprised. The image of Alyosha rose to his mind. Last night, and only imagine. Madam, said Mitya, I can imagine nothing except that I am in a desperate position, and that if you don't help me, everything will come to grief. And I, first of all, excuse me for the triviality of the expression, but I am in a fever. All right, we're going to end it there for today. He's in a fever. Very cool. All right, have your say of this chapter over at reddit.com/r/theHemingway list. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.